Look, I'm Nick Cohen from The Observer and many other places, and I'm here to welcome you to... This is actually the paperback launch of Danny Dorling's book, All That Is Solid. Thank you so much for all getting here so early in the morning. Only the British left and Labour movement with its stack-and-fight determination to work 24-7 to drive the hated and parasite Tories from power would get you here at 8:30, going through the rush hour traffic and offer you only lukewarm coffee. In return. There are, however, other rewards. I reviewed this book for The Observer, and I was really blown away by it. There are debates on the whole go down tramlines. Most people you hear speak or read, and you know what they're going to say or write before they've said or written it. With Danny's book, which is packed full of inspiration, but also I hope will be an inspiration for Labour policy, should we have a Labour mayor in London, or should we have a Labour government after May, is that people who talk about the housing crisis nearly always say we've got to build more, which we probably do. And I always went along with that, even though I've learned, I'm from the north of England, and I always regarded the southern countryside as a bit wussy and not proper countryside with mountains, whatever. I've learned to love it, and even though I love the southern countryside and don't want to see just great urban sprawl. But where Danny really pulled me up was by saying, well, look, it's not just there aren't enough homes. We need to redistribute space. That over the past 50 years, the rich have got more and more space. There are more than enough bedrooms in London for everyone. The problem is how space is distributed. Now, I don't know if Danny or Tom wants to talk about that, but what you can do about it, you can hear the howls of protest events, Labour and Liberal Democrats, really very modest measures for a mansion tax, which would be a kind of tax on space. But as I said, if you read Danny, I find this of all his works, you're constantly pulled up. You're constantly given a new perspective. So, I mean, if you haven't got a copy already, I would... recommend very much that you read this, and particularly if you're involved at all in housing policy, because certainly in my case it made me think again very hard about assumptions I probably accepted a little too easily. Now what we're going to do is, as it's Danny's book and it's his party, we're going to let Danny speak first, and then we'll have Tom Copley, who's the housing spokesman for the Labour Party on London Assembly.
Yep.
Yeah. And Dawn Foster, who is a journalist who covers all this and knows 10 times more than I do. And I will just chair and get people to shut up occasionally, and then we'll take questions. Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, Danny Dorling.
Thank you. Thanks ever so much for coming this early in the morning. Please don't forget to take a copy of the book or take one for a friend, maybe. I thought the way I'd do this is talk about one of the claims in the book which maybe is most extreme, which is the claim that housing is the defining issue of our times. This is a kind of attempt very early on to get a stake in for what we should think about this decade, what is the thing that may be seen in future to matter most, and if housing is the defining issue of our times, why are we not doing a better job of it? So I thought I'd have a little look through defining issues or the ways that they're looked in the past. I was born in the 1960s. If you look at how we define the 1960s, we talk about it as swinging. Most people were not swinging in the 1960s. You could probably define it as an era of full employment, an era when we come out of austerity, and not a bad decade. If you go to the 70s, history tends to be written by the winners. So the 70s are often defined as being an era of strife. But the 70s were a battle between labour and money and inflation. And for many people, the 70s were a very good decade. My parents, when I asked my parents what was the best decade, they say for them it was the 70s. It was in the 70s when, for the first time ever, most of us got to go to the same schools as everybody else living in our area. And these things hadn't happened before. If you go through to the 1980s, I think the defining issue of the 1980s is mass unemployment. Now, when you look back at the 1980s, it was mass 3 million people unemployed. It was my age cohort who were part of that. If you look back at the 1990s now, I would say the defining issue of the 1990s, what makes the 90s stand out in terms of social geography and change, is the 90s was the era in which inequality really rose. It was the big rise between the haves, the might haves, and the have-nots. And these three groups are really interesting. The haves tend to know what they have, and they tend to behave in a particular way. They get very upset when what they have might be threatened. The have-nots tend to either not vote or vote for one particular party. The might-haves are the groups you're always arguing about, the people who life might get better. And that's, you know, what politicians are trying to appeal to, is the might-haves. The 2000s. I suspect when we look back at the 2000s, the way it'll be talked about in future will be the crash. The crash is the most important thing that actually happened in the 2000s. It won't be terrorism, which is what we thought at the time. And then this area. And this area, the argument is housing. You've got a picture slowly changing behind you. That picture is showing the boroughs of London and the regions of England, each sized by the total volume of residential sales. So that's prices times number of sales. If you take 2 noughts off the end of that figure at the bottom, so just take 1% of the amount of money, the one I'm standing in front of, I apologise, just got up to, what is it, 171 billion. Take 2 noughts off, that's how much money estate agents made in that year. And you can kind of see it going up and down. And we're just approaching now the housing crash of 2007. That's what the housing crash looks like. And the point of putting this up for you and showing it changing slowly is to show that we're not yet back up to the volumes we were at 2007. The prices are much higher, but the amount of property changing hands isn't yet that high. So, by historic precedent, it could carry on going up for a bit longer. The Council for Mortgage Lenders predicts that some $222 billion is going to be lent through mortgages to buy housing this year, so a record high figure. The worry, of course, is our history of housing is we have these things, we go up. I first researched housing in the late 1980s, early 1990s, so my formative years of doing housing research are all about negative equity, the first time we got that. This book came out in hardback in February last year, February 2014. It was remarkably easy to update it, to be honest. I did a lot of changing. Average house prices might cross the £500,000 threshold in London, too, did cross the £500,000 threshold. Changing homelessness rates might rise to homelessness rates, did rise. I'm not a great soothsayer, but in the short term, simply suggesting that your current trends are going to continue, you generally tend to get it right until something big happens. To save you any time, if you've read the hardback, there are a set of pages at the end, which is my summary of everything that's happened of significance in the last year, which is essentially homelessness has risen, social cleansing has increased. Susan Fitzpatrick did a talk for Crisis a couple of weeks ago where she used the term absolute immiseration, which I've never heard her use before for the situation of some people in housing. House prices and rents are continuing to rise to record levels, and the Chancellor is continuing to find new ways of spending public money to keep the housing market as high as possible. Since he became Chancellor in 2010, the main thing the Chancellor has done is find various ways, like Help to Buy and, you know, pension annuities and changing stamp duty levels, all of which help to keep house prices high and rising. It's absolutely sensible for him to do it from the point of view of winning an election. And there is a really interesting debate to be had over the next few weeks about the relation between politics and housing and house prices, and a debate, I think, to be had over what is the incentive for the Chancellor, if he's Chancellor after the election, to carry on dedicating so much public money to keeping house prices high if another government had got in for 5 years, just to give you some sort of worry about the wobbles over house prices. We spend an enormous amount of public money on housing. The housing benefit bill's astronomical. The Help to Buy commitment, this is the commitment to encourage banks and building societies to lend money to people they do not want to lend to, because we collectively are going to underwrite the loss if there is negative equity and they default. That commitment gets up to a maximum of $130 billion if this program carries on. It is an astronomical amount of public money is spent on housing, not spent on building housing, not spent on actually making the quality of it better. And a huge amount of it simply diverts and goes into landlords' pockets and so on. But don't think we have a private housing market. It's a private housing market assisted by a huge amount of state money. I'll just go through five things I think need to happen. The first is that our governments really need to stop spending so much money trying to keep housing costs so high. Housing costs may now be higher as a proportion of people's incomes than they've ever been, because before the war it was actually food which was the highest part of your spending, not housing. So if you're trying to improve standards of living, rents coming down, house prices coming down is the fastest way to improve standards of living for the majority of the population. It would be nice if they were to come down gradually, what I call the Grant Shapps model. When Grant Shapps was housing minister, he said he wanted to see house prices rise 2% less than salaries and wages. If house prices had risen 2% less than salaries and wages from that point, though, of course, they were falling at that time, house prices would have fallen even further. Grant didn't actually realise what he was saying when he said that, but he did say it, and it actually was quite a sensible thing to say. I always get annoyed with trade unions spending so much time worrying about upping their individual members' salaries and wages, whereas collectively, if they could try to get their members' costs down, it wouldn't just benefit their own members, it would benefit the whole of society. Well, put it another way, you can have all these brilliant campaigns to get a living wage, you know, and citizens' income and so on in London. Completely pointless if the rent goes up faster than the increase in the wage you've managed to secure. You don't actually end up with any more money. Secondly, and what Nick mentioned, we do need to recognise just how inefficiently we are now distributing our housing. I have a graph in the book, which was taken from an early paper by Becky Tunstall at the University of York. That paper's now being published. And it shows that the inefficiency in housing, that is the gap between those who are most overcrowded and those who are most underoccupying, if you like, has now exceeded the previous maximum in 1921. We've never wasted more space in our housing system than we waste now. We're wasting space in London. The population of Kensington and Chelsea has been dropping. The number of empty properties has been rising. We're building skyscrapers which are being left, not even worth renting out the flats if you sell them on to somebody else in China. And what people often forget about this is it's not just a waste of money. When somebody builds one Hyde Park, that space could actually have built something else that might have housed people rather than be in a sense a hotel which is incredibly under-occupied. When Norman Tebbit once complained when his man was driving him from the House of Lords past all these properties where there were no lights on to get him to where he lived so that he could sleep for the night, he did see something a little bit inefficient in this. Now, if I could ever come to an agreement with Norman Tebbit about how we, you know, solve the problem of members of the House of Lords or members of the House of Commons, I mean, this is quite incredible who's affected by this problem. Why does an MP who's managed over 40 years to get themselves a reputation for being, you know, a very strident, very, very good man, in almost retirement, feel the need to go and do some work for a few thousand pounds for some company because they can't live off £67,000 a year? It's the cost of housing. Why do people say they can't be government ministers? Because the salary for a minister is too little. It's the cost of housing. Why do people argue up their salaries in London? Why do they say, I can't possibly be head of your local council for less than £200,000 a year? It's not because a lot of them are that greedy. It's they just want a free bed semi. I mean, and that's, you know, I know I should be concentrating on the problems of housing for the worst off in society, and the people who are being decanted away from their only support network, which is granny. That's the problem about moving people to Stoke, is you're taking them away from the thing which is the most useful thing in their lives, which is a family network. But I go on and on about the problems of housing for the rich and the problems of housing for people at the bottom of the 1%, because if we've managed to muck up our housing system for the very best of, you would hope we would begin to do something about it, except that housing is so intricately related to politics and to winning votes. When the price of housing fell after 1989, and it fell in London in the early 1990s, very large numbers of Conservative voters didn't come out to vote in local elections, and the Conservatives lost control of a whole series of London boroughs, because their loyal supporters have a tendency to stay at home when their house price is falling. And I don't think George Osborne doesn't know this fact either. And it's a real problem. If you have engineered a situation in which there is, in many ways, no such thing as society anymore, there's only yourself and your family, then the rational thing to do as a middle-class family is for the grandparents to hold on to the 4 or 5 bedroom house for as long as possible. And when granddad dies, and it's normally granddad dies first, granny stays in that house on her own. She might be very lonely. When surveyed, she'll say, I actually don't like having to pay for the cost of heating this house and I hate cleaning it, but I kind of feel some obligation to clean every room because that's what I always did. But for the good of her grandchildren and the good of her children, the longer you can stay in that house, the higher it'll go up in value, so that when you die, you can give the rest of your family the deposits they will need to have a chance to start out on the ladder. The problem with this model, the no such thing as society model, is it's incredibly inefficient in the aggregate. That's why we end up with so much wasted space. If we could, or when we do, because this can't carry on forever, have a situation in which our house prices are slowly going down towards, say, a German level. Germany is a country which is not particularly badly housed. Then, if you're a grandparent and you're worried about the money and the future of your grandchildren, the faster you choose, I wouldn't coerce anybody, the faster you choose to downsize out of that property, the better off your family will be. Because the longer you stay in it, the less money you would have to give them. Now, our problem is, and it's a good problem, we haven't built the kind of flat housing that we need in our 80s and 90s, because not many of us until now have made it into our 80s and 90s. And a little bit of the reason, I don't think it's the majority, but a small part of the reason for the incredible inefficiency in housing is the good news that we're living longer. When we died in our 70s, this was very good for a housing system because we vacated family homes at a relatively early age. We need mild rent regulation. I've learned to call it mild rent regulation. The kind of mild rent regulation that other European countries have, the countries in which families, people like me, would choose to rent rather than buy. I do not like fixing gutters anymore, but I never really did like fixing gutters. I don't like DIY. I would much rather somebody else was worrying about all of that for me. I'd be willing to pay a premium for that. The reason why I don't rent is it's more expensive. It's actually cheaper to get a mortgage. And I've got kids, and they've got friends, and I don't want them to lose their friends when somebody decides they want to sell a house under me. This is entirely solvable. We've only got to look to many other countries and choose which is the best. And we'll move there very slowly. Any hint of moving there, anything that says that three-year tenancies should come in, will of course dampen down the housing market, which is part of the solution, but we need to move towards that situation. The utopic situation is one in which I can rent, the tenancy is long term, the rent cannot go up by more than inflation when I'm there. And if my landlord really decides that they want the property, they have to offer me a sum of money which they have to increase up to the point where I go, okay. Or I might just say, no, I'm sorry, I value my children's friend more than I value the £20,000 you're offering me to get out. It's a market. It's a different kind of market. Taxes. Nick mentioned the mansion tax. Taxation can be a useful way for controlling housing and particularly speculation. Kate Green, who was on the Monetary Policy Committee, has suggested capital gains tax on the rise in value of housing to deter people from fooling themselves into thinking that they're all going to pay their pension through their housing. This does not work. It doesn't work. My only plea on this is I would ask you to call these things the Osborne tax. And the reason is that George brought in capital gains tax on non-doms, which comes in, I think, from April this year. So George Osborne has brought in taxation on speculation housing gains. Very small, only for non-doms, but from April this year. So just extend that initial taxation of wealth which George Osborne brought in. It's slightly like, you know, the Labour Party brought in tuition fees of £1,000 for students. The hard thing is bringing that in. It's very easy to raise these things once somebody has actually done it. Building. Most of our problems will not be solved by building because you cannot possibly build the amount you would need to build so fast to solve them. And most of our spare capacity already exists, but we do need to build. We need to build for the unpalatable reason that no politician can say, because our population is rising due to immigration. No politician can say the reason why we actually do need 200,000 houses, because we're fortunate enough that people who are highly skilled, young, and who somebody else has paid for their education want to come to this country. But we are going to have to build. We're going to have to build in London. You can build centrally in London. London is a very low-rise megacity. And you need to build in places like Oxford. Oxford now, we've just managed to beat London. London, your average house price to your average income is now a 15-to-1 ratio. Oxford, because we don't have London waiting, our average house price is now 16-to-1. Unprecedented in the history of Oxford, which has always been an expensive city. 40,000 people are driving every day in cars across Oxfordshire to the car parks on the edge of Oxford, polluting all the air on the way so they can come in for their jobs. Oxford has a lot of land on the east and west side of the city within 4 miles of Carfax from which you could cycle into work. And it's off the floodplain. And it's owned by some very rich colleges who really would still be very rich without that. And in fact, the majority of academics, well, I won't go on about Oxford, but you can't solve your housing problems with extra housing that requires people to drive. This is my point about this. Because our roads are full. So you have to build up small towns which have got ways to get into bigger towns through public transport. And if possibly, you have to take the power of Simon Jenkins. Let's say that. The power of Simon Jenkins, which is don't...
Sir Simon Jenkins.
Sir Simon. Sir Simon. Of arguing that you shouldn't be adding 100 or 200 houses onto the edge of every little village. If you could only get the people who are willing to invest so much time in trying to get housing not built right next to their house, to also say where they would like it to be built, which is actually where people would like to live, which is nearer the place they're actually trying to get to work. Because the jobs are not in those villages. You do need villages that can support a primary school, but most, you know, the people want to be here in London. They want to be on the towns, and that's where we're stopping them being. I'm going on too much, so I'll just end with a prediction. There's going to be an earthquake. That's what the graph behind you suggests. We've just made it proportional now, so it's less dramatic. There's going to be an earthquake. Geographers are very good at telling you about earthquakes. We're great. We know exactly where earthquakes are going to happen. We draw maps which show you this part of the world doesn't get earthquakes, this part of the world gets earthquakes, and so on. What we're really bad at doing is telling you when the earthquake's going to happen. We can even tell you that the chance of the earthquake is increasing. It's overdue. You know, it's really shaking. But we can't tell you when it's going to happen. Nobody can actually do this. If they could, the richest people in the world would actually be people who had speculated on the market, which they're not. The earthquake can happen any time, but there's no way it won't happen within 10 years. Because in 10 years' time, the first cohort of university graduates, half of all young women in Britain now go to university. In 10 years' time, the first cohort who have debts, if they've been successful, if they've got a good job, the first cohort with 56, 60, 70, 80,000 pound debts come on the housing market as first-time buyers. And they've already, in effect, got a mortgage of that much. So my institution, the higher education sector, very cleverly has helped fund itself by taking a bite out of the future housing market. That's why it's not going to fund your pension. You can't carry on doing that. That's 10 years away, but it could be nearer. The reason, one of the many reasons why we have a boom now is because the Americans are allowed to inspect Swiss bank accounts. I'm sure everybody who had a Swiss bank account had money in there for legitimate reasons, but for some reason they all decided, or large numbers of them decided, to get it out just before the Americans could look in and buy property in London, where it's safer. We have attracted all this money from the rest of the world to blow this bubble up. The super rich money really matters because it makes completely unaffordable house prices appear affordable. In the town where I grew up, a dodgy two-bed flat in one of the worst council estates will now cost you £300,000. And £300,000 is seen as reasonable because there are some houses a few miles away going for £1 or 2 million. This will come to an end. It has to come to an end. Let's begin to get it to come to an end in a better way and work out how our children and our grandchildren are going to be better housed so that we don't end up remembering this decade as that was the one where we tried to emulate Tokyo to see if we could have an even bigger crash than the Japanese managed to have before their two lost decades. Thank you very much.
Sorry, Danny, can I just ask you, because I assume everyone else got it. When you were saying that the graduates of now or a few years ago are going to come on to market and sort of house with already with 80,000 debt, that means house prices will have to fall because they simply won't be able to. I mean, the supply won't, unless prices fall, there won't be the demand.
The money that they might be spending on a mortgage, some of it has been taken out. All 3 years, first, second, and third years at university, are now all paying largely £9,000. You won't have to pay it back unless you get a good job. Now, it's the people who get good jobs who get mortgages. Right? So it's beautifully aimed at the first-time buyer market, to the ones who are going to have to pay these fees back. You might say, oh, they won't have to pay it back at all, this system won't work. But then the taxpayer will have to pay it back. Who's the taxpayer going to be in 10 years' time? It's going to be them. Unless we managed to persuade the rest of the world super rich, and half of them have already bought a flat in London, to keep on coming in here because this place looks so safe as an investment. And you already know that house prices are going down, in the very hearts of the most expensive. Bishop's Avenue's dropping by a couple of million. It's not tenable, but it's very interesting to look at the debt we're putting on to successful young people and think about anybody who has a plan that says, I've managed to buy this house in Essex, I've got 15 years to go, and when I retire I'll sell it to somebody and I'll move, I don't know, to Cornwall, and that huge profit I make will compensate for the fact that I never got round to sorting out a pension for myself. The people you're hoping are going to fund your pension, I'm afraid we've already taken the money out of their pockets now to pay for the higher education that they have to go to, because if you don't go to university, what kind of a job are you going to get?
And one thing, because this might lead on, I don't know what Tom wants to say, and of course you can say whatever he wants, but this might lead on a bit to what he may want to talk about. I was surprised, apart from capital gains tax, I was surprised you paid in your talk less attention to what the tax system could do, land taxes, whatever, revaluing council tax. Or in some sense, is that less important than the other things you're arguing for?
Housing is so precarious that the tiniest government initiative can have a huge effect on it. Or even if Labour were to pull away in the polls and begin to go up, I mean, supposing they got their campaign together and got on with each other and some of those ministers actually stopped hiding in there, you know. Supposing the Labour went...
big issue.
Yeah. But supposing if Labour were to go up in the polls as you approach the election, so a mansion tax looks like it's on the cards and so on, what happens to the housing market in London? Even that matters. Yet, Winston Churchill argued for land value tax. You know, this has been a very long, long debate. He argued for it because he was born in Blenheim Palace, but he didn't inherit it. You know, eventually one day we might get to a land value tax. You can get these things very, very quickly. Ireland has managed to register all its land in 2 years. We say it's impossible for another 20 or 30 to do ours. Ireland's documented all the land and is taxing people with a progressive tax, which is hated in Ireland. If your home's worth more than €1 million, you actually pay a higher rate because the Germans are insisting upon it for the debt repayments. But you can do that within a matter of 2 years if you need to. I wouldn't have called it the mansion tax, although the nearer we get to the election, I kind of think maybe confrontational politics might be better. I would simply bring in a whole series of council tax bans which are progressive, so that if your home is worth 10 million, you at least know that the person whose home is worth 15 or 20 is paying a higher amount than you. So it isn't unfair. And the other thing you have to say about the mansion tax, I get letters from people who tell me that 25 years ago they bought a house somewhere in London, they're on an average wage, the house or the flat's now worth £1 million and they can't possibly pay the mansion tax. And I just say to them, you can get a mortgage, they own it out right now, you can get a mortgage for £20,000. You can pay the mansion tax from that. And when you sell your flat, you'll still make £980,000. You'll still be richer than I will ever be. But we're not very good at our... We can even look at American states to see better ways of taxing housing. You know, there aren't many things where we can actually look to America for where they do it better in terms of progressive politics. But the Americans managed to have taxation on housing, which encourages people not to under-occupy property. I'm all for it being your right and your freedom, should you wish. I mean, I can tell you, when I rented in Oxford last year, opposite the house we were renting, there was a man living in a 9-bedroom house on the Banbury Road, all on his own. I don't object to that, because I'm such a hippie. I just want that person to be paying an awful amount of tax for the privilege of their predilection for some, you know, if somebody really feels the need, if having 9 bedrooms, I don't know, is your thing, you know, I'm not starting this, but you know, contribute for it.
All right. Well, that segues with a sort of neat local radio style to Tom, who, as you know, Labour spoke to the Assembly on housing and thinks about tax morning, noon and night.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Nick. And I apologise, I've got a bit of a cough. I hope I didn't catch it from Natalie Bennett, but if I have some sort of mental brain fade, whatever she called it, you'll know why. I think that I'm actually someone who's very much in favour of building. But I think there's many, many great things in Danny's book, because as he said, even if we were to begin sort of mass house building programme tomorrow, we're talking sort of at least a decade, really, before that's going to start to feed through into anything. So in the meantime, we are going to need some other solutions as well. Just to take it back a moment, I mean, one of the great things in the book is the idea of you know, housing as a fundamental need, a fundamental right, something like food or something like that, it's shelter. It's a human right. For me, housing is the most crucial thing. It's at the centre of people's lives, the home. Home is at the centre of people's lives. And it has such a profound impact on so many other aspects of people's life, the conditions of your home and the affordability of it. So the impact on your health, both mental and physical, and on children's education. And I think once you start to get housing right, you start to get so many other things right. Because if you've not got a decent, affordable place to live, You can't function properly as a productive member of society if you're constantly worrying about how you're going to pay your rent at the end of each month, or if you've got damp on your walls causing your children to have asthma. It's so important that we get housing right, and it's why it's so tragic that for so many years we haven't got it right. There was a very interesting piece, I thought, last night on Newsnight about this idea of an intergenerational divide. And they were talking to David Willett, who I think wrote a book about how the baby boomers had it all and then messed it up for the rest of us. But even when they're interviewing him, I don't think he quite sort of got it, because he was talking about, well, pensioners, you know, if they've got any disposable income, they'll give it to their grandchildren. And I thought, well, that's all very well if your grandparents are wealthy. But if your grandparents aren't wealthy, where are you going to get your money from? And this is the big problem that we've got ourselves into. Because you yourself, you can come from a very, you can come from a poor background. You can have done really well. You can earn a very decent wage. But unless your parents or your grandparents own their own home, it's becoming less and less likely that you will ever be able to own your own home. And it's not just a divide between generations, not just an intergenerational divide. It's a divide between people who have got rich parents or well-off parents or well-off grandparents, and people who haven't got well-off parents and well-off grandparents. And I think this is where this fundamental unfairness comes in. You can work very hard, you can do very well, and you still can't afford to buy a house, if that's what you want to do. Or indeed you can't afford, or indeed you can't rent somewhere at a reasonable rate, because the cost of housing has got so out of control. So as I say, I'm very much on the side of building. But I think the crucial thing is that we have to build the sort of houses that people want to live in and that people can afford to live in. And that's why I talk so often about the importance of council housing and getting councils building again. Because if I were to put one slide up onto the screen, it would be what I call the graph of doom, which is house building essentially since the 1920s. And you look at it across all the tenures, local authority building, housing association and private. If you go back to 1978, local authorities were building a third of all the homes that were being built in this country every year. And that was at a time where, every year, and then 1980, right to buy comes in. One decision that the Thatcher government made, which was to prevent councils from replacing the homes that were sold. We then see the rapid decline of council housing. And if you look at the graph, the gap that was left by councils was never filled. It was never filled by the private sector, and it was never filled by housing associations. And last year in London, across all tenures, we built about 17,000 homes. In 1978, councils alone built more than 17,000 homes in London. And that was at a time when London's population was falling. Now we're in a situation where London's population is the biggest that it has ever been. And we built fewer homes last year than councils alone built in 1978. So this is the crucial thing. Getting councils building homes again. It is that gap in genuinely affordable council and social housing which we have to get going again. So we need, for example, the government to be lifting the cap on councils borrowing to build. That's going to be absolutely crucial. But just to go very briefly a few of the things, the other things I think we need to be doing. Land value tax, absolutely right. I completely agree with that, and something that I hope to be doing an investigation on our planning committee in the next year. In terms of more efficient use of our housing stock, I think we need to be looking at things like upping the threshold, a tax threshold for people who take in lodgers. That's about £4,000 at the moment. It's not gone up, I think, since it was introduced. And if it had gone up with inflation, it would be worth about £8,000 a year now. I think that's very important, not just in terms of encouraging people to take people in and making more efficient use of the housing stock. But also, I think it's a great social benefit, say, to an older couple taking in a younger lodger, and the social benefit to having groups of people who might not ordinarily have mixed that much, mixing and learning from one another. I think that's absolutely crucial. And finally, to the point that Danny made about rent regulation, I'm glad you called it mild rent regulation rather than rent control, because that really, I think, is a direction that we're moving in, this sort of second or third generation European style rent regulation. If we're going to have, and we already in London have a quarter of people renting, if we're going to have more and more people renting, we have to make it affordable and stable, particularly when we have families living there. So we need longer tenancies. We need to get rid of a landlord's right to chuck you out for no reason. And we need to stop the landlord being able to whack up the rent by whatever amount that they choose. And I would like to see us move towards this German model. In Germany, they have unlimited tenancies. A landlord can't kick you out. And my favourite thing about the German system, if the property isn't in 100% of a good condition, you don't pay 100% of the rent. It's stipulated in the contract how much your rent will be cut by until the landlord sorts the problem out. These are the ideas that we need. So, yes. So things in the short and the medium term to do something about the very immediate problems that we face, but also for the longer term, a very serious programme of house building, of genuinely affordable homes that people can afford to live in.
Tom, if you know, as seems likely, Labour win London mayor in the next election, what can you do? What can you do without central government approval or parliamentary approval?
The wonderful thing about the Office of Mayor is its ability to essentially create powers and things for itself unless there's any kind of legal impediment to the Mayor doing so. So what I would like the Mayor to be doing is looking at, say, setting up some sort of city wealth fund and getting investors to put money in, using that money to invest not just in housing but in other infrastructure projects, and then being able to pay a return on that investment, which of course would be funded in a large part by the rental income which would come from these properties. I think it's that kind of thing the mayor should be doing. He can already do it. It's simply having a mayor with the political will and desire to do it.
When you were talking about council housing, you didn't say, I don't know what Labour Party's position is, I mean, why not just stop the right to buy? I mean, why should councils, by which it's the public, it's you, it's your taxes, why should they build homes as are then sold as a discount? It's like councils just giving money away. You wouldn't do it any other way.
I would certainly seriously reform it. I'd get rid of the discounts. I'd give councils the right not to sell. I mean, I don't think we're in the situation. I don't think a policy that was put in place in 1980, where we had twice as many council homes as we have now, is, to use that awful term, fit for purpose. At the moment, I think if not abolished, and certainly reformed to the point where it's actually very difficult for anyone to exercise it.
Okay. Well, Dawn's going to speak next, as well as Danny. He sort of, you had all your recommendations.
Yeah.
And you said, well, you know, building, very nice thing to do, but, you know, the idea, this is a solution short or medium term. And Tom sort of sidestepped some of my thoughts.
We're going to have to build, if we're fortunate enough that more people want to come and actually want to emigrate from here. I'm not in favour of building council estates anymore. I am in favour of councils building some housing, but there are other groups who want to build housing. I generally like them all apart from Barrett's. And Barrett's are sponsoring the Centre for Cities reports about Oxford. You know, you can see they've got their eyes on this. And it's those tiny little detached houses with a one brick gap, so you can say it's detached. Can you imagine your city surrounded by them? But there are many other groups who want to build. On the right to buy, I agree with getting rid of the discounts. There's no justification for the discounts, and there may have been originally. But we have a thing called the right to sell. It's in different laws in England, Scotland and Wales. It doesn't exist in Northern Ireland. But if you find you become ill or you lose your job or you split up, and you can't pay the mortgage anymore, councils or housing associations can become your landlord and take the property off the bank who actually owns it, and you can become a council tenant. This is the most And it's used, many hundreds of families in Sheffield have used it. It's not used much in London. This has the brilliant effect of creating, in effect, social housing properties on streets which were fully owner-occupied before. The main predictor within a city of a house price is how far away is it from the council estate. If your neighbour's house could suddenly become a council house, now they could always buy it back again, but when they leave, somebody off the waiting list comes in. Paying money not to live next to poorer people suddenly sort of becomes a fool's game, and again it dampens the housing market, and you mix up tenure. It no longer becomes a stigma, you know, whether you own or rent. Because the Germans have got to a situation in which, and it's not quite as good as this in Germany, but the situation in which you choose to buy when you like being your own landlord, and you choose to rent when you don't, but you're not going to make money out of buying property, because you can't make money out of buying property now unless somebody else is going to lose out very, very badly. There are many groups who want to build housing, and it's not just councils.
Sure. Well, in terms of mixed tenure, though, certainly where I live in Camden, I mean, there are large numbers of street properties that are still the Georgian terrace houses that our council, because if Frank Dobson could give you more than 6,000 when he was leader of the council, were bought up by the council in the 70s when it was cheap. Oh, but so you have that mixture already in many parts.
When it crashes, the time for councils to buy is at auction. You know, if we are stupid and we let it rise even bigger than 2007, and we have an absolutely almighty, you know, I'm not wondering, but if you do, the most stupid thing would be not to do what you do in the 70s and let the state buy at auction property at rock bottom prices.
Right. Now, we've now got my colleague Dawn Foster, and I don't know what to say, but I suspect that whereas Tom and Danny have talked about law and theory, Dawn has a little more experience of what it's like living in a city whose population is exploding, and I don't quite know how it can, somebody was saying it's going to go up to 10 million, and where on earth all these people are going to go and how they're going to live is something perhaps we should all be thinking about too. Anyway, Dawn.
So most of what I do is social affairs journalism, which is report on inequality, disability, old age, that sort of thing. I was at an event recently, and someone from the DWP referred to me as the Guardian's misery correspondent. So,
overall.
So I spend a lot of time going around the country talking to people about issues they're facing, and what I've noticed over the past 4 years is, regardless of what their issue is, if I go speak to people who are asylum seekers, if I go and speak to people who are disabled, if I go to speak to people who are experiencing domestic abuse, no matter what they see as their main problem, housing is also a big, big issue for them. Now, I grew up in South Wales on a council estate in a council flat that I saw on the market recently. It's a two-bed, you know, one of the worst council estates in Newport. And unlike Danny's £300,000 one, it was on the market for £30,000. So that's one-tenth. So there is this massive, massive inequality in house prices because we have this unbelievably stilted economy at the moment. It's really geared towards the southeast. If you look at where the jobs post-recession have been created, around about 90% of them are in London and the area surrounding it. And at the same time, more and more people around the country are experiencing increasing levels of poverty. I found it really interesting what Tom said about the focus I've seen quite recently on intergenerational inequality. I'm never wildly keen on focusing just on that because, as Tom points out, it completely disregards class. Mm-hmm. So, when I grew up in a council house and my family still lived there. They had a tenancy for life. I remember being extremely poor, worrying a lot about the stigma of poverty, but never worrying about housing, whether or not we'd be evicted and that sort of thing. Whereas now I speak to a lot of young children who are living in hostels, who've moved a lot of times. I think I saw a study recently that said that children of the age of 11 who move a lot have a massively increased risk of developing psychosis symptoms. So it's not just about being able to afford one home. It's about what having to move constantly does to you as a child. It's not just losing your friends, it's not just losing your support network. It genuinely impacts on your mental health and your life chances. One thing I really liked about Danny's book was the focus, you know, the fact that he mentions council tax. Council tax hasn't had anywhere near as much attention as the bedroom tax that the Coalition have introduced. But for a lot of councils, council tax benefit has been removed, and the impact of that is absolutely huge. And it basically involves absolutely tiny sums of money. So all of a sudden, the poorest in society, who've never ever paid council tax because they only get subsistence benefits, are suddenly being asked to pay between £5 and £9 a week out of their benefits towards council tax. And what happens when this comes in is not that people are suddenly a bit poorer, it's simply that they can't pay. And once they can't pay, they get a summons from their council. And I have a friend who works in the council tax department in Enfield Council, and when this came in, his manager came in and said, print out a summons for everybody in the borough and put it in that filing cabinet, because it's going to be quicker to do that than it will be to make up a summons as we go along. Enfield Council used to have one day a week where they would call in people who hadn't paid their council tax. Often it was footballers who apparently don't realise that the rules of life apply to them. But, I mean, Dennis Bergkamp was one. Don't let that go further in this room.
tweet that.
But now, I mean, I've been to Southwark Court, I've been to Tottenham Magistrates Court, which is where the Enfield cases happen. Enfield are now having between 2 and 3 days a week where they are summoned in thousands of the poorest people in their borough. These people turn up, they're beside themselves, they have no money. And on top of this, they also have the £100, £120 court fees that happen. And this is they're then given an attachment to benefits order. It's taken directly from their benefits. And around about, I think, the New Policy Institute said that this had affected 250,000 people in the UK. And around about a third of those people are also hit by the bedroom tax. I met a woman in Sandwell who, she'd been sanctioned, she'd been hit by the bedroom tax, and she'd been hit by council tax. After paying her gas, her electric, her water, she was left with £2.50 a week. And it cost her £3.50 return on the bus to get to the job centre to sign on every week. She had to walk for an hour each way to get to the job centre, and then somehow feed herself on £2.50 a week. And this is all because of housing policy. This woman was in she wasn't in a council flat, she was in a private rented house, and she had housing benefit, but because she was subject to the bedroom tax, she couldn't pay it anymore. So I'm seeing more and more of this, and it affects domestic violence victims especially. I was in a refuge in Hackney recently, and everyone there said that that ordinarily women would spend between 3 and 6 months in the refuge before being moved to social housing in a safe place nearby. Instead, in Hackney now, they think that it's increasingly hard to move them into social housing. So women are told, you can have a private rented property, but the landlords are then demanding a rent guarantor. If you fled your home, you've cut off all of your networks. You don't have people who can financially support you. You don't have often you don't have contact with your family anymore. These women are stuck in absolute limbo, and they're either moved, you know, to Stoke, to Hastings, or something like that, or they stay in the refuge for a long time. Every single woman said that she regularly contemplated suicide, and all they wanted to do was move on with their lives. And the only thing stopping them was the housing crisis. I think part of the reason why the housing crisis has suddenly had so much attention in the media is that all of a sudden journalists and politicians are realising that A, their housing costs have risen, and B, their children suddenly can't buy houses. But I think we all need to accept that it is a lot wider than that. And I mean, that's why Danny's book is important. It points out just how much inequality is at the root of the housing crisis. So.
Is Labour, if elected, are they going to reverse the, on council tax?
As far as I'm aware, they said they'll reduce bedroom tax. I was writing a piece on council tax not long ago. Hilary Benn's office were very, very helpful with statistics. And then suddenly withdrew at the last minute because they said that Ed Miliband's office weren't sure about their policy on council tax. Okay. I've asked repeatedly and I can't get any clarification on it. And it's hit Labour councils hardest, so they really, really should be looking at council tax. And that's why I think Danny's point that actually the alphabet's very long, we can just add a lot more bands, make council tax progressive, take the people who can't afford a bit out of council tax, and ask people who have made huge sums on their house to maybe pay an extra £50 a month.
Well, I mean, we'll let the audience have a question. I mean, there's one point that's often forgotten, because culture in Britain is so dominated by wealth, and as you say, you know, people write about their class, so it's an issue because children who have middle class can't buy a house. But of course, the aggressive impact of council tax isn't just there aren't enough bands at the top, but people at the bottom are paying too much. Yeah. It cuts both ways, you know.
I get letters from people who've become private landlords, who've got one property or maybe two, telling me how hard it is, how bad everything's gone, how they haven't managed to actually cover the mortgage because they didn't realise how hard it was to deal with tenants, often because they've different kind of people, and they just make a mess of it. And they really annoy the tenants, and they upset themselves. Well, the sensible model is that if you're going to be a private landlord, you have a number of properties, not just one or two. And the ideal, the utopian German situation is when it's a pension company, a pension provider that owns the property. So people paying a very reasonable rent know that their rent is going directly to the pensions of elderly people across Germany. And that's what you're doing. And this is not utopic. This happens all, it's not just, it happens all over Northern Europe. But we don't look that way. We look to the US, which has had the most almighty housing crash, has the worst homelessness in the world, and where the common experience of black women, the common experience of black men in the States is to be imprisoned, you know, at the highest rate. The common experience of black women is to have gone through at least one eviction. It's no news if you've done it. That's what you do. And to look at that model, whereas we've got one so much nearer to home, yeah, I just think it's ridiculous. And we need to get to a situation where if we're paying rent, it'll be lovely to know that your rent is actually going to pay the pensions of the elderly people who live in your town.
I think on Germany, I think I'm right in saying that Germany is full of amateur landlords as well. It's actually not, I think, not hugely more pension funds than we have, but a lot of Germans who rent also own a property, but they don't live in it. Yeah. And it's this very sort of German, you know, stereotypically German sort of efficient way of working, which is you move to where the jobs are. If you're an owner-occupier, it's difficult to move to where the jobs are, so you rent somewhere else. Yeah. And actually, it's also efficient in the sense of if you're renting, you only rent the size of property that you require. You don't have spare, lots and lots of spare rooms.
But the other thing is you have 30% of house building is self-building. But it's not amateur self-building, it's self-building with little building companies who actually have built a house before. Whereas here, we have lovely, you know, very nice friends of mine who decide in their early retirement that they're going to build their eco-home, which is great. But, you know, the first time you do anything, you're not that good at it. Okay.
On your first point about business, it's crucial to make this argument that the housing crisis is going to... It's going to undermine London's economic competitiveness. And we found when we did our report into private renting on the housing committee, every 1% rise in rents takes 150 million quid out of tenants' pocket into landlords' pocket. Tenants are much more likely to spend that in the economy than landlords are.
There's a lovely essay by Martin Amis. It's the opening essay of his collection called The War Against Cliché. And it describes him and Clive James being in London in the early 70s. And all they argued about was literature and writing a piece for the TLS on the latest trends in novels was the greatest thing they could do. And then suddenly, OPEC starts to go bonkers and the great house price rises of the 70s begin. And Martin said, suddenly we found that literary criticism was something that the economy could no longer support, because we could only do it because we were paying virtually nothing for our housing costs. And suddenly we all had to do other things, and he makes a big joke about literary criticism being economically unviable. But for Tom's point, I think it is true for London. If young, bright people can't afford to come here and just try their hand at things, and maybe fail quite a few times, but pursue their ambitions, this city will oxify. We'll get like Geneva or somewhere.
And we won't, in business terms, we won't lose out to other UK cities. We will lose out to our international competitors as well, which is a crucial thing.
Anyway, there's you. Sorry. This meeting is overrun, but I think that, I hope you agree, it's because it's been very interesting with panellists of the highest calibre. So could you just give them a round of applause before you go?